This is an ABC podcast.
Unemployment is 4%, very low, lower than it was before the pandemic. But the number of people who get unemployment benefits is bigger than it was before the pandemic. It's a conundrum. We're going to get to what we think is the bottom of this conundrum shortly. We'll also hear how the Russian war in Ukraine will affect economies for years, actually decades, because of the decisions that governments will make in response. Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is The Money. We'll start with the Reserve Bank putting up the cash rate. Zach Gross used to work at the RBA. These days he's an economics lecturer at Monash University. He says the rate rise was a matter of when, not if. So why now?
Although from a macroeconomic point of view, it doesn't really make a big difference if they increase interest rates in May or June. From an economist's point of view, they would have basically the same impact on the economy. The RBA wanted to send a strong signal that they were going to respond to the very high inflation report that we saw in last week's CPI numbers. When we saw those high prices across the Australian economy, the RBA thought they had to react, and that's why they pushed up interest rates.
You've written about this, Zach. The RBA was going to wait a bit longer for the latest data on wages, which I think was due a few days before the election. Why was it going to wait for that?
Well, the RBA wants to make sure that inflation is growing in their target band at a sustainable rate. Now, we know that there's a lot of turmoil in the international economy at the moment. We've got lockdowns in China, a war in the Ukraine, and both of those have been pushing up prices around the world. But the RBA wanted to make sure that it wasn't just these one-off international shocks that may or hopefully will disappear relatively soon. They wanted to make sure that the Australian economy itself was generating its own domestic inflation. And in order for them to be confident that that was the case, they initially wanted to be sure that they were seeing increases in domestic wages, because you're unlikely to see increases in Australian inflation unless you have Australian wages growing as well. And so that's why they were initially keen to wait for the official wage data, which is due out in a couple of weeks' time. But ultimately, the inflation report that came out last week was just so strong that they thought they couldn't wait any longer.
They also had other information from this business liaison program that they have. How does that work?
That's right. So not all RBA economists spend their time mired in Excel spreadsheets. They have a team of economists that they call their business liaison program. And what these economists do is they go out and interview businesses around Australia in every state to try and get a sense of the Australian economy in a more real-time way, because the statistics that the Australian Bureau of Statistics put out often come with a substantial time lag, and the RBA really wants to know what's happening in the economy today.
So the data that was gathered by that business liaison program, that obviously fed into the RBA's decision-making here.
That's exactly right. So while they didn't have the official wage statistics for the first quarter of 2022, they had considerable data from both their business liaison program, where they were interviewing these businesses, and also from more formal business surveys run by some of the big banks. And all the other indicators were telling them that firms were increasing their wages in order to try and attract more people to join the labour force and to work for them. And so while the RBA didn't know the final official statistics on wages, they had a pretty good idea that they would be a step up from what we've seen over the past few years, and that wages are starting to recover in the Australian economy.
So is there a sense then that these wage rises that the team found could be enough to catch up with the price rises?
Look, I think that's still unlikely, and that's just because the increase in prices was so dramatic in the first quarter with what we saw with petrol prices and food prices. Overall inflation was running at 5% And so I think while wages will be higher, I don't think they'll be that high. So we should still expect to see real wages falling over the first half of the year.
We have a paradox, don't we? Wages are rising enough to help push the RBA's hand, but not enough to stop most people from going backwards.
That's right. That's right. I think the big shocks, especially to the petrol price and increasingly what we're seeing in the supply chain from China, means that ultimately we are going to be worse off. We are going to be poorer as a result of the turmoil in the international economy. And there's not a whole lot the RBA can do about that. But it's something that hopefully we should recover from as the economy slowly adjusts.
So the other thing is the rate. Zach, the cash rate was increased by 0.25 percentage points. Why that number?
So that's a good question. Economists were pretty confident that the RBA would increase interest rates at their meeting this month, but there were a range of possible outcomes. Some thought they would just put them up a little bit to get Australians used to the idea of higher interest rates, and some thought they'd increase them by as much as 0.4 of a percentage point in order to try and head off that higher inflation. Ultimately, the RBA decided to increase them by sort of standard 0.25 percentage points. And the message they're trying to send was that this was a standard rate hike of the standard amount, trying to push the economy back into a sense of normality with interest rates slowly increasing by their usual amount.
So much of what the RBA does is to try to land on the Goldilocks kind of number, isn't it? The just right thing. I'll say this for your profession, Zach, you're not short of different opinions. You'll be aware different economists have argued that the bank went too early, that most of the inflationary pressure is external and will pass, and some have said it didn't go hard enough. So that's an observation rather than a question.
Look, I guess it means that you'll always be able to find one economist that was bang on the money, given that we've got such a wide spread of views.
That's true. I love the old joke of, you know, economists have predicted 12 of the last 9 recessions, but we'll move on. Where are we going to get to with the cash rate this year? Because the markets think it's going to be 2.5% by Christmas.
That's right. And that's an incredibly steep forecast, because what that effectively means is that over the next 6 meetings that the RBA is due to hold in 2022, that they will increase their interest rate by more than 2 percentage points, which would be a lot of hikes. That is a very aggressive forecast by financial markets, and I think one should give pause to consider whether it's a realistic forecast. Having said that, over the past year, there's been a lot of disagreement between what the RBA said in terms of their projection for the cash rate over the next year and what financial markets thought the RBA would end up doing. And time again, the financial markets have proved to be right. So it's a steep increase, but I don't think we can rule it out entirely.
So I'm interested in that. Because you're not the first to remark on it. Indeed, it's been remarked on quite a bit that the RBA has not done so well on forecasts as the markets have. You used to work at the RBA. Why do you think that is, that the markets have been better at forecasting than the RBA, which prides itself on its forecasting?
I think there are two factors you need to consider when thinking about whether the financial markets will be right again. And the first is this idea of the wisdom of crowds, which is, while the RBA has a lot of very smart economists, there are many, many more participants in financial markets, and that collective wisdom may be more accurate than the relatively small group of economists who are working at Martin Place. And the second reason why you might want to put more weight on what financial markets think is that at the end of the day, they're putting their money where their mouth is. A lot of these financial market predictions are backed up by millions and millions, perhaps even billions of dollars. And so they've definitely got the right incentives to sharpen their mind and make sure they get the best forecast that they think they can make. So, look, I guess we'll have to wait to find out who ends up being right this time. But I certainly wouldn't write off the possibility that interest rates will keep on rising over the course of the year.
That issue of the difficulty of forecasting, how is the bank likely to respond? Because I'm sure it will want to be doing better.
That's right. I think Governor Philip Lowe said he was a bit embarrassed by the bank's forward guidance and how wrong it ended up being. And I think one thing the RBA might end up doing is starting to talk less about specific numbers and more in terms of ranges for any future forward guidance they issue. So instead of saying the interest rate will be at, say, 1% at the end of the year, they might instead say it'll be between 0.5 and 1.5% by the end of the year. And that shift from talking about specific numbers to ranges for numbers should give them both a bit more wiggle room in terms of forecasting where the economy will end up, but also help the Australian people understand just how much uncertainty there is in the economy and how hard it can be to predict the future.
Indeed. Zach Gross from Monash University. This is The Money with me, Richard Adey. To the conundrum, Professor Peter Whiteford's in the Crawford School at the Australian National University.
The conundrum is that when you look at the number of ABS unemployed, and the most recent figures are for March this year, there are, I think, about 580,000 ABS unemployed. But if you look at the number of people receiving the main unemployment payments, which are now Job Seeker and Youth Allowance for younger people, there are about 935,000 people receiving those two payments. So there are many more people on those benefits than the ABS unemployed. Now, since COVID, the number of ABS unemployed has fallen very substantially, whereas if you compare the number on benefits with just before COVID, it's actually gone up.
Okay, so that is weird. Now, I think we have to go back to before the pandemic. How many people, roughly, were unemployed, and how many were on unemployment benefits?
Say you take the middle of 2019, there were about 690,000 ABS unemployed, and there were about 770,000 people on the unemployment benefits.
Actually, I feel I need to kind of understand that, Peter, because a non-social scientist might expect those numbers to more or less line up, but I'm guessing there's two things going on. Some people are unemployed but not receiving benefits, which seems very weird, and some people are receiving benefits but not unemployed.
Yes, both those statements are true, and that's part of the conundrum, that there are significant numbers of people, both before and after COVID, who are on benefits but not classified as unemployed. There are two main reasons for that. One is that the benefit income test allows you to work part-time. In fact, at the minimum wage, you could be working 4 days a week and get a couple of dollars of unemployment payment. So those people are in paid work and receiving benefits, and that's been encouraged by governments actually since Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister in order to help people get back into work by taking up part-time work. Then there's a group which appears to be much larger, but we don't know the precise number, who are not in the labour force. And that's because even though they're receiving unemployment payments, they're not required to actively look for work. And again, that's a result of policies that successive governments have introduced, mainly since the early 2000s, basically to move people off other benefits, other working age benefits, with the idea that if they're looking for work, they're more likely to get into paid work. So starting in 2006, a lot of lone parents started getting unemployment payments rather than parenting payments. And also there were some restrictions on people with disability who were also encouraged onto unemployment payments. So there's this growth of people who are on unemployment payments, but they are not required to actively look for work. And so when the ABS comes out and conducts a survey, those people will not be counted as being in the labour force.
Now, the other thing that's happening is that people are unemployed, but they're not receiving benefits. Now, I can think of a few reasons for that. Maybe you've got a partner who's earning too much money, or maybe when you lost your job, you got a redundancy, or maybe you've got some liquid assets, and I know they like you to exhaust your liquid assets or nearly exhaust them. So things like that could stop you from receiving benefits, couldn't they?
Yeah. As you say, there's a liquid asset test waiting period. It makes you wait up to 13 weeks after you claim a payment. So you'll be unemployed during that period, but you're not getting a benefit yet.
Yeah, okay. So there's a bunch of reasons. There's actually more than we've touched on, but I want to keep moving. So in summary, there are more people receiving unemployed benefits than are unemployed, but not everybody who is unemployed is receiving benefits, which is where we were and where we are. But what changed with COVID?
Well, there was a substantial increase in unemployment. And what the government did was they introduced the coronavirus supplement, which made the level of payment much more generous. But basically what they did was they suspended most of the other conditions. So the liquid asset test waiting period was suspended. If you had a redundancy payment, et cetera, that was suspended. There's a thing called the newly arrived residence waiting period, which means that if you've been a permanent resident for less than 4 years, you're not eligible for benefits. That was suspended. So all of these conditions were suspended. So what happened was twofold. All of the people who lost their jobs in that period became eligible, but also all of the people, possibly 400,000 of them, who were ineligible before because of these conditions, but were already unemployed before COVID, they also became eligible. So there was this massively larger increase in the number of people who became entitled to payments, even bigger than the increase in unemployment.
So getting that benefit became much easier, and it became, as you've mentioned, pretty much doubled in size by the coronavirus supplement. So it became really worthwhile. That is sort of where we got to. But the benefits started to be wound back in September 2020. Why wouldn't things begin to return to normal from then?
Well, they did start to return to normal. So the numbers started falling from about August 2020, the number of people receiving payments. But it was much slower than the reduction in unemployment. So in the second half of 2021, we had the Delta variant, and that also had a big impact on the labour market. A lot of people received the emergency payments because they were isolating or because they had COVID. So that interrupted some of the changes in the labour market as well. But what appears to have happened is that previously we also excluded people who are regarded as highly paid part-year workers. So if you were a fly-in, fly-out worker, for example, they were also excluded from payments by preclusion periods in the Social Security Act. If you were a relief teacher or a relief hospital worker, you're excluded. And if you had, say, for example, you were a highly paid IT worker who had short-term contracts, or I think people who work in arts and entertainment, you would have been previously excluded. Now, what happened, of course, in COVID and again in 2021 was a lot of those people, it's possible they were no longer excluded because they didn't have that highly paid work, which before COVID meant that they weren't able to get into the system. So these exclusions that we had beforehand probably didn't work the same way after COVID as they did before.
Do we know if this is kind of, to use a much overused phrase, the new normal?
My feeling is I think that what might happen is that particularly if arts and entertainment and all of the associated types of activities sort of resume and go back to the normal pattern that they were before 2020, then this will be temporary. And people like fly-in, fly-out workers, presumably that's started to resume in a normal way. So it may not be the new normal, but it could persist for a while yet.
Well, all right. Let's see if that happens. Peter, thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
Thank you very much.
Peter Whiteford's the director of the Social Policy Institute at the ANU. We know that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is already affecting our economy. Its effect on oil prices is a chunk of the inflation that we talked about earlier. It's also going to have longer-term effects on economies all around the world. Simon Rabinovich, who's the US economics editor at The Economist, has written about this very issue.
There's no question that the invasion of Ukraine is the immediate prompt for the increase in military budgets. You know, for many years, America was complaining that its partners in NATO were not spending enough. And basically, as soon as Russia marched into Ukraine, you had governments from Sweden to Italy, and especially to Germany, agree to quite significantly increase their military spending.
Do you think this will reverberate in other places, other countries?
Well, there already was, I hesitate to say an arms race, but there already was something of an arms competition between the world's two biggest powers, between China and America. And that was already beginning to intensify, not just in terms of the amount of money that was being spent, but the sorts of weapons that were being developed. China's hypersonic missile, for example, which America is apparently trying to catch up to. And they have increased their budgets, you know, even more than what was expected in the wake of the war in Ukraine. And it just stands to reason that, you know, with European governments increasing their budgets, China and America spending more, there'll be pressure felt far and wide around the world, small and big countries, to increase their spending on defense.
Of course, that will have consequences. And you lay it out. The argument against increased expenditure on the military is that of opportunity costs. The money you spend on defense means you can't spend it somewhere else, maybe education or health. But it turns out to be a bit more complex than that, because it depends also on how well established the economy is.
That's right. So, I mean, I'm far from a military hawk, so I kind of went into this analysis expecting to find that, generally speaking, more spending on defense will have negative effects for economic growth. You know, the classic model that is taught to students in economics is this idea of guns or butter, the idea that governments have this basic choice, and if you spend more on defense, you have less money left over for things like education and healthcare. And I think that's true if you just kind of look narrowly at a budget in one given year. You know, if a government has X amount of money to spend, the larger share of that goes to defense, the less you'll have left over for other things. But when you actually look at it over time, there's not a direct relationship like that. If you look especially at more developed economies, those that spend more on military don't necessarily have slower growth over time. If you look, for example, at the OECD group of countries, it's about 40 of the richest countries around the world. Consistently, the biggest spender on military as a share of its budget is Israel, which I guess is no surprise. But Israel is also one of the strongest growing countries in the group. Consistently, one of the countries that spends the least on its military as a share of its budget is Japan. And Japan is consistently one of the slowest growers of the group. So it's not to say that more military spending leads to higher growth. In fact, you can find examples of countries that spend very little on the military and grow quite well, like Ireland. But it's to say that there's not this direct link of causality between spending more on the military and having worse economic outcomes. There's just no direct predictable relationship like that.
I suppose there is an issue in smaller developing countries, perhaps, where they don't have robust institutions and perhaps have issues around governance, where if you're spending a lot of money on defense, that's going to be a channel for things like corruption.
That's absolutely right. And so, you know, researchers who've tried to sort of work out whether there is a pattern have come to the, you know, I hesitate to say it's a hard and fast conclusion, because the nature of economic studies is that people are always able to come up with a variety of different objections and qualifications. But the tentative conclusion is that, you know, military spending doesn't necessarily have a positive, but it doesn't necessarily have a negative effect in wealthier countries. But in developing countries, as you mentioned, big military institutions tend to be a bad thing for growth. And one of the suppositions as to why is because a big military is a big vehicle for corruption. You know, there's much less accountability. The military can basically ride roughshod over the private sector. It can begin to seep into all kinds of different business sectors. So people can both use the military as a way of plundering treasure from the national government, and equally they can use the strength of the military to encroach on areas that really should be left to the private sector. If you look at, for example, a country like Egypt these days, one of the big concerns is just how big the military is, how many different non-military sectors it's now involved in, everything from dairy production to property development. So an example like that, I think, is a clear case where a lot of military spending is not going to be very good for the economy. It's probably not great for national defense either.
You're obviously in the US, which is still the largest military spender. And you, something you wrote, I was really struck by, that there were some economists who think America is spending too much, nearing the danger zone. What is that?
Well, for example, people often talk about, well, a good military budget is roughly 2% of GDP, because that's what NATO has specified as a goal for its members. But that's purely a political target. There's no law of economics that says you should spend 2% of GDP. It could be 1.5, it could be 2.5, it could be 3.5. The concern in America is, you know, clearly it spends more as a share of its GDP than most other countries in the world. It's roughly about 4% of GDP. As a whole, America accounts for about 40% of global defense spending. So it's, you know, it's a big, big spender. And the national debt in America is, you know, increasing year after year. And so the concern from some researchers who look at the amount of military spending in America is there an external threat that justifies that level of spending? So nobody knows exactly where the danger zone is, except to say that, you know, maybe America could afford to spend a little bit less on its military, and that might be a good thing for long-term economic sustainability.
One of the positives, though, is out of military spending, you get R&D, and there's a recent study that supports this argument with today's military expenditure. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. So it was a paper that was published last year by a professor at the University of California in Berkeley, Enrico Moretti, along with a couple of other colleagues. And their basic conclusion was that when there is a big increase in government spending and funding for research and development, especially focused on defense spending, that tends to have a positive knock-on effect for private sector R&D, and then looked at in aggregate, that increase in R&D in a country tends to lead to an increase in overall productivity levels. And so you can look then at specific examples, you know, in America, the kinds of innovations that have come out of the military industrial complex. You know, that's something which is often used in a pejorative sense, but, you know, there really is a military industrial complex in America, and it's generated a range of innovations, you know, over the years. So, you know, you could look at the development of the internet, the development of GPS systems, you know, even the development of duct tape. These are all things that had their roots in American military spending. And so the conclusion is that at some level, this military spending does lead to kind of a range of spillover benefits, a range of civilian applications that go far beyond the original military intent.
You can see how that would work. And of course, we've got the products that prove it. But isn't there a counter argument, Simon, that just governments funding R&D more generally would get the same effect?
You're absolutely right. And I think in a perfect world, that would be the way to do things. But I guess the fact of the matter is that public support for fundamental scientific research, it doesn't necessarily get sustained when you don't have results. But there is always going to be some level of public support for national defense, for national security. And so that's why the military, I think, does end up being a reasonably good vehicle for government spending and funding for R&D.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Simon Rabinovich at The Economist. And that is it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.